Welcome to the Cutter's Notch Podcast, a program created by Michael DeCamp, the author of Abandon Hope, a Cutter's Notch novel. Recorded in the Cutter's Notch Studios, this podcast is focused on all things creative, with special forays into books and matters of faith. Join Michael as he catches up with an author, a songwriter, a painter, a comedian, or anyone working or supporting a creative endeavor. So turn up the volume, listen, and catch up on what's happening in Cutter's Notch.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Cutter's Notch Podcast. I'm Michael DeCamp, your host, and this is episode number 5, I think. And I have a special guest with me today, Tara J. Hanna. And we'll get into her stuff here in just a moment. But I do want to open the podcast, as I usually do, by discussing a book that I've recently read, which relates nothing at all to what Tara is going to talk about in a few moments. It's just pure fiction. Every once in a while, I have to read something that just takes me on an adventure. And this one definitely did that. Tara, are you familiar with the Longmire TV series?
I am not. I don't have cable and I don't have Netflix.
Well, it's on Netflix. It started out on cable. I can't remember what channel, but after the first couple of years, they axed it and Netflix picked it up and it was actually better on Netflix.
Good.
It's the Longmire series, but it's based on a series of books by Craig Johnson. And this particular one is called Hell is Empty. And in the book, the reason it's empty is because all these horrible criminals are running loose in the Bighorn Mountains of Wyoming. It was a great adventure. I'll read a little bit of the blurb, and that way you can get an idea. Those of you listening out there on in podcast land, it says Walt faces an icy hell in this New York Times bestseller from the author of The Cold Dish and As the Crow Flies. It's the 7th novel in the Walt Longmire mystery series. So, let's see. Well-read and world-weary Sheriff Walt Longmire has been maintaining order in Wyoming's Absaroka County for more than 30 years. But in this riveting 7th outing, he is pushed to his limits. Reynaud Shade, an adopted Crow Indian, rumored to be one of the country's most dangerous sociopaths, has just confessed to murdering a boy 10 years ago and burying him deep within the Bighorn Mountains. Walt is asked to transport Shade through a blizzard to the site, but what begins as a typical criminal transport turns personal when the veteran lawman learns that he knows the dead boy's family. Guided only by Indian mysticism and a battered paperback of Dante's Inferno, Walt braves the icy hell of the Cloud Peak Wilderness area, cheating death to ensure that justice, both civil and spiritual, is served. So Walt goes on this frozen adventure into the Bighorn Mountains, chasing this guy on foot up the trails as all the way to the peak.
And, good.
The guy is he's a bad guy, and he keeps turning around and shooting toward Walt, and somehow or another through this strange Native American mysticism thing, it was an interesting story.
Well, this icy mountain sounds like hell to me, but
yeah. Well, I think one of the things it references is in Dante's Inferno, the ninth ring or something. I haven't read Dante's Inferno. I probably should. I bought a copy a few years ago, but it's that's a tough read. So anyway, I think the ninth ring or whatever is actually frozen. So, which is
interesting.
Different. Yeah. Very interesting. So that's the Walt Longmire book, Hell is Empty. If you all like the Walt Longmire series, check it out. If you haven't read the Walt Longmire series, I recommend it. It's a fun read. And Walt's a great hero, to kind of follow. But enough of my reading habits. Today, I'm excited to have Tara with us, and Tara is a new author. When was your book published?
May 1st, 2019.
So just a few months ago.
Yes.
Yeah. And she's from beautiful Kokomo, Indiana.
That's right.
And I tried to, you know, Tara, I was going to, Nancy and I were going to try to come up to your, book release party.
Oh yeah. We had a good time.
Yeah. But unfortunately we had too many things here and we couldn't get away.
Right.
We could have made it up there like for the last 5 minutes or something.
So right. That wouldn't have been fun. You'd have missed all the activities.
Yeah. That would have kind of, that would have kind of blown the whole deal.
Right.
But I'm excited to have you here. Tara and I have known each other for, well, we won't say how long, but it has.
Yeah, it was last century.
Last century. Yeah, we've known each other since the last century. So, boy, that really is a scary thing to say, isn't it? So, Tara, how did you wake up one morning and think, you know, I think I want to write a book today?
That was never on my radar. I practice as an occupational therapist. I'm a mother of 4 children and a wife. And so at the time I started writing the book, I was working as a home health occupational therapist, part-time, and still managing with the kids and family and all of that. With 4 of them, it's quite a few responsibilities, and their ages right now are 9 is the youngest and the oldest is 16. So they still need some help, but they're becoming more independent every day, really. But so these days I am full-time in a private practice in therapy. So I run a rehabilitation practice and I also run a fitness business for women. So my rehabilitation practice is women's rehab, and then the fitness part is women's fitness. So my whole career in the world of careers has always been about the bodies of women. And so during the years I was a stay-at-home mom, for the most part, I always did a little bit in the hospital to keep my skills up, or had a part-time job that way. But for the most part, a lot of my career was spent doing fitness for women. And in that, you understand a lot. You see the challenges that women have in being in their bodies. Mm-hmm. And so I had that from the fitness point of view, helping women achieve their fitness goals. And I also experienced that as a therapist in helping them achieve their functional goals. So, for example, something that always kind of surprised me was how embracing older women were to go to assisted living. So most people, when they're kind of on that bubble or that's looking as a part of their future, they don't want any part of it. And they're doing everything they can to stay at home. But when I was out on the field, I would notice a lot of women wanted to go to assisted living, but often their husbands did not. And even as widows, then the women want to go to assisted living. And what this was they had been caregivers for all of their lives. They were the ones taking care of their husbands in the home. They were the one taking care of the kids in the home. And the husband didn't want, you know, they wanted a break. They were getting old. And I would talk to the husbands about, well, your job to care for her is to make sure, like, if he was the sick one and she was a healthy one still caring and sane, I was like, you can't kill her with this. I said, your job is to make sure her needs are taken care of. And sometimes that may be to bring in additional help to take care of you, mm-hmm. because she can't have that. And you need to think about taking care of her. And so anyway, you know, through the lifespan of women, there's often a special place or a special, you know, that's usually caring for other people that women are assigned. And in my own experience and Christian religious experience, it was the same sort of thing. And I got to thinking, in just my own spiritual life, what does God really want for women? What is the power? I mean, there's more, and caring is a very important work that women do. And men as well, we are called to care for each other as people. We need each other. But there seems to be that what does God really want from this? Because I was given this script that said, your job is to submit to men and to care for the family and to do that. But there was never a encouragement as far as your job is to go seize this opportunity or go, you know, own this or go put the stake in the ground or that, you know, whatever it may be. As a woman, that was never told to me. And so I started doing research on this and I,
So at this point, it's just personal study of your,
yeah, it was personal study. It was personal Bible study. And I started doing research and I kind of was introduced to the feminist theology from academics. And so it was a coincidence. There was actually a conference in town and I asked if I could come. And it was these feminist theologians that were meeting in Indianapolis and, you know, they were like, yeah, sure. Why not? You know, so I paid my whatever for the, and I thought it was a whole weekend thing. I just paid for one day. Cause I'm like, these people might be really wacky and I don't want to spend a whole weekend with wacky people. So I'll just go for one day and drive down. And I wish I'd have stayed for the whole weekend. But I did go for one day and I was, so here's all the theologians. And these are people who are on committees to write the Bible and how the Bible is translated and all of that. And they're talking about dealing with these other people and their whole. And so then here's Tara, the occupational therapist and mom and fitness instructor sitting quietly with my mouth shut. Yeah. And so listening to all of this, but I was also then exposed to some really amazing resources that I had no idea were out there. And so I, you know, I bought up my books and, you know, whatever and said thanks. And I joined a membership fee. I'm like, you know, I want to keep in touch with these people because they have some incredible resources here. And so the more I started reading, the more I realized that you can't get this kind of information and not share that. It really bothered my conscience. Like this needs to be, we're taught to see the Bible really one way, and it's through eyes of men and ancient Jewish men, and seeing it through feminine eyes or eyes of women is an entirely different point of view. And so I felt called to share that and share it in a way that was more engaging. And as much as the information was already out there, and none of it's really my original research or anything, it was really boring because it's academic. And yeah. So while I have the ability to read through that and to, you know, stay with it, I didn't feel like people who have the same questions I had would. And I also felt like I put in some, just with my experience in the whole understanding women from a physical perspective, there's a big question in Christianity as far as the flesh. And so what does it mean with the flesh of women? And I felt like that was one area that I could contribute to the conversation as far as how do women flesh out their faith in their female flesh? What does this mean? Because you're going to find when you get down to that in the Christian conversation and really any conversation in religion, the meaning and the value of the female flesh is much different than the meaning and value of the male flesh. And so I really did feel called to contribute to that part of the conversation. So in that, they invited me to their conference next year to present. So that, wow. Yeah, that was kind of exciting. I'm really nervous because I can't, you know, these are theologians and people who devoted their lives to the entire, you know, study of the Bible. I'm just a person. I'm not a theologian. I'm not, those aren't my things, but I did have, want to share. And I do have that point of view from the flesh of being present, and really detailed, you know, doing women's rehab now, just a specific physical and health needs that women struggle with. I deal with that on a daily basis. And one of the big things that I deal with is helping women understand their bodies specifically. We're taught to use our hands and we're taught to use our minds, but we're not taught to use our feminine flesh.
Right, right. Well, I suppose at this point we haven't actually shared the title of your book.
Well, we better do that. Yeah.
It's Pink Sunglasses and Yoga Pants, 31 Reflections on Biblical Feminism.
Yes.
That last word is going to get a few eyebrows.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're out there and you just heard the title of that and you like or tempted to turn it off, well, you can do that if you want to, but I think you'll miss out on. And at least listen and open up your mind a little bit and let's just don't get caught up on a word. Right. So let's talk about it.
Yeah.
But before we get into the content of the book.
Yes.
That's how you kind of that was kind of what was the impetus for you to write the book was just this whole you went to this conference and you felt like you needed to share these concepts with more people. But how did you actually start writing it?
Well, you know what? I sat down and I started writing and I'm busy. I mean, I've got children and husband
that's what I was gonna say.
And
all of that.
And yeah. Yeah. So, the way you start writing a book is you sit down and write it. So up about, 5 a.m. each morning. And, I started writing. And
was 5 a.m. your normal time to get up?
No, that was a little bit earlier. I usually am up around 6, but I decided I could get up at 5 and do this. And yeah, see, so I would write a couple hours.
That's a point for those out there who are thinking about writing something. You have to set aside a time.
Right.
You have to set aside.
Right.
Time. So right. Go ahead.
Well, and you need help to structure and edit it. So I'm fortunately friends with an English professor who somewhat was informally helped me with structuring things. And then later on, I hired an editor when I had more content and the structure of the book down. Then I hired an editor and a copy editor. And that actually was the key to help me continue through writing and finish the book because I had deadlines and I was paying a person to do this.
Right.
And so that did keep me going.
Very good. Very good. Now, how did you get it out there to the world? I mean, it's released. How did it get published?
Well, I've self-published. And so I basically put it on Amazon and I told my friends. And my hope is that when they learn something, they tell their friends. So it's kind of a grassroots thing. So like being here and again, it's probably, I mean, selling books is always a good goal and stuff. It's my financial aptitude. I mean, it's nice having, you know, Amazon put money in your, you know, account, or if I'm invited to say like a woman's conference to sell a few. One woman, she had a copy and she's like, hey, I want you to come. I'm going to give you a table at this women's luncheon and you just sell those books there. So those are great opportunities. And so it's just one person at a time.
So did you use, just the Amazon service for publishing or did you use another?
I did. And I did. I used the Amazon
Kindle Direct Publishing.
Yeah. I think they, I mean, I guess there's definitely discussion on, I think they kind of rape the authors a little bit. You know, it gets it out there for people. There's good and bad about it, but it is, I mean, at the end of the day, it is what it is. And you see what the contract is and you,
It is hard, you know, as someone who also has a book out there,
right.
it's hard to get it to get published traditionally. And I hope to have some traditional authors in and talk about that. And one day I hope to be traditionally published.
Really?
Yeah, I hope to be. In fact, I hope to have news on that sometime, not too awful distant future, but,
See, I didn't even look into this. Yeah. I just decided I looked at it and I'm like, these guys are pimps. I mean, that's what I looked at the publishers. I'm like, and I started looking at all of this and it's like, well, they'll give you money up front, but you're a slave to them forever. These guys are pimps.
Yeah, that's
good. Well, and so I'm like,
I'm
my
not sure
book
I would
charges.
Have put it that way.
Well, no, that's how I look at it. And so it's, you know, my book sells for $24.99 and I hired an editor that expense is done. These are all, I had all fixed costs. So now what I make goes directly towards that. I get, I mean, a book, I don't know, it costs $5 to print it or something like that. And so the $20, I get that. That's all of mine. It's where with the publisher, I mean, there may have been an advance on that, but I only get $1. And so they might be able to get your message out there more potentially, but you're also a slave to them. And I want to own 100% of my business.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that's part of this discussion with this podcast is, you know, what are the different avenues? avenues,
yeah,
and the ins and outs of those.
Right.
Excuse me. When I published mine, I used it's a local publishing company that mm-hmm. focuses on helping independent authors be mm-hmm. self-published. So ultimately I used a publishing company, but I'm considered self-published.
Right.
And those people, I won't tell you their name.
Right.
I don't want to advertise for them at all.
Sure.
They basically, it was like getting any money out of them was like squeezing blood out of a turnip.
Right.
It was terrible.
Right.
But you know, the disadvantage of self-publishing is you have to do all your own marketing. You have to do all your own selling. You have to do everything yourself. The
right.
advantage of the traditional side, the advances aside,
mm-hmm.
Is they have this whole publishing arm or this whole marketing
platform.
Arm.
Yeah.
They have mm-hmm. the ins to all the bookstores. Mm-hmm. They can get it out nationally and worldwide.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you may only make a dollar, but if you sell a million copies,
yeah,
that's pretty good. But if you if we self-publish, you make a bigger chunk. You don't have the advance. The other advance, yeah, the thing about the advances, from my understanding, is you know, they give you a big advance, but you have to sell enough books to cover the
right.
cost of the advance before you start getting any royalties over the top of that.
Right.
So it's it's kind of a trade-off. So if you it kind of depends on what you want to do. So.
It is. That does. And I know, I mean, being a business owner, especially a small business owner, I don't believe in the volume approach. I believe in leveraging your clients for more money versus, you know, leveraging the community for more clients.
Right.
And so, taking that as far as part of my book.
Quality versus quantity.
Right. Right.
So on the mm-hmm. one hand, you got to sell a million copies to make a bunch of money. But on the other hand, if you do it the way that you're approaching it, you don't have to sell nearly as many to make a little bit of money. So.
Right. And these are people I know. When I sell a book, I mean, it's usually signed and I know the person and there's a relationship there. And that was kind of the whole point of writing the book, is to have a relationship with them
right.
and to impact them in a way that would help women find their power that I believe God created them with yeah. that most people aren't telling them that they have.
Well, let's jump into the book a little bit. So where'd you come up with this title, Pink Sunglasses and Yoga Pants? Where did that come from?
Well, finding from a different lens or looking at scripture from a different lens, the pink sunglasses, there's a story in the book where I am in Hawaii, actually with my husband. And I talked about that it was just like going, how difficult it was to get four kids situated with grandma. I think it was our 10th anniversary. And then leaving them, you know, going across the Pacific Ocean. It was the first time I was that far away from my children and trusting they're okay. These are babies. And so we had this little private suite in Hawaii on the beachfront. And so I was having a quiet time and on my deck in the nude, except for my pink sunglasses. And so seeing life in my body that way was kind of where the pink sunglasses come through. And so, being secure in that and having that experience. So that's from the pink sunglasses. And the yoga pants is, again, being in the fitness thing. I was wearing yoga pants in the 90s before yoga pants were even like, jeans. Yeah, they were selling more popular then. But yeah, I've pretty much lived my entire life in yoga pants as a fitness professional. And so just the different, judgments I've had on wearing the yoga pants, I kind of discussed that. I mean, and you know, the yoga pants is kind of a theme throughout the book. Because most of the time when I was living my life, I was in yoga pants. Now in the clinic, I do not wear yoga pants, and I do believe in, you know, wearing dress clothes, and I actually wear a white jacket in the clinic and all of that. And I'm pretty formal that way, but, still often I'm in, you know, if I'm teaching a class or going to the store or, you know, I may wear the tunic that covers the yoga pants, but yeah, I still wear a lot of yoga pants.
I don't.
No. Oh, you should, you know, well, and actually this is a funny joke. I was on a, some conversation. And it was one of those, every once in a while, the Christian conversation will be like, oh, they're not supposed to wear yoga pants. And I start talking about, which we never discuss what men wear, but it's always about what women wear, you know, in the Christian conversation. And so they were, you know, there's the side where the yoga pants are evil and bad and terrible. And then there was the side where like, whatever. And I got on there and I said, you know, maybe you guys, men that were saying that they shouldn't wear, I was like, maybe you need to wear yoga pants for accountability for your problem with women wearing yoga pants. So nobody ever chimed in after that, except one blogger did chime in and he invited me to do something on his blog, but nobody. So I think that men who have problem with yoga pants should wear yoga pants to have accountability for their problem with yoga pants. It would really help them out and it serves the purpose.
Wow. I don't know what to say to that. You're definitely right. I think if men wore yoga pants, their issues would be obvious.
Yes. And there's accountability and it's all, the whole thing would work out just fine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. Okay. Let's move on.
Okay.
What else do you want to share with us about the book, Tara?
Well, there's three sections. The first section,
I think I'm blushing.
That's okay. It's what it is. And so but this is part of the issue when we, you know, it's so good.
Yeah.
Okay. So the first section's power to her, and this is literally structural power within, society that has been, confused or misconstrued through a biblical perspective. For example, God's first social command to people was man should leave his family and then go with his wife, right? And so there's different, the merge or whatever you want to call it, mm-hmm. cleave to his wife and all of that. Well, that was God's first social command. Well, what ended up happening, and we read in scripture, Abraham and his family, is that they coerced women to leave their homes. And so you read in scripture, it was very much a matriarchal kind of home. And so Rebecca's like, well, let me go ask, you know, my mom, I go to my mother's house and all of that. And so if woman stayed in the home of her parents, a man actually followed that command to leave, then we wouldn't have the patriarchal setup. And so this was addressed later on with Jesus. And so he talked about the parable of a wedding. And so everybody's kind of confused. Oh, the virgins are going to hell, those bad virgins, you know, or they didn't do their job. And like, that's not even the point there. The point of that, one of the subtle points that the Jewish people listening to that would have recognized is that the wedding was at the home of the bride. And so that wasn't how tradition was followed. And so, but we miss that entire point and we continue, you know, with the patriarchal setup, it's like woman, Hannah is a author name or a pseudonym. And so when I was married and my professional name is my husband's name, and I took that on. And then even the name I grew up with was my father's name. And so these, you know, matriarchal names are kind of lost in oblivion. And so we don't get that. But I don't, you know, looking at scripture through a feminist lens, we don't see that that was God's plan for women to be folded into the identity of men. God definitely left room where women could have babies and could work. Because if you're at the home of your parents, then they're going to be able to provide for that and watch the children. So the woman could contribute to the family business or whatever was going on at that time.
Okay.
So that's kind of it talks about the structural changes of that. That is a example. There's 10 reflections in that one. And then the second section is body language. And so that's all about the bodies of women and what women, how women have been branded in a not so great way, and not just Christianity. This is really in all religions. And so owning the flesh of women as good is really established in this section, discussing the power plays between the the power in the flesh of women and the power in the flesh of men, and how there's been some, a lot of abuse on that one. But I touch on that only a little bit. I feel like so much of the conversation on the body language stuff, it just immediately they'll start talking about abuse. And it's like, it's more than that. Like, let's talk about the ways that women can find power, not how we're abused in power, you know? And so, and how our bodies, you know, how can we label and own our bodies? And one of the ways that I feel that women embody the power of God is we shed blood. So we have the bodies that our bodies shed blood for the renewal of life, and women deliver life. This is the work of God. And so owning that is women. And I say, you know, my body's broken. My blood is shed for your life. You know, my kids, yeah. You better, you know, blah, blah, blah. But this is what, you know, a lot of that symbolism has been appropriated in the Christian faith. And so, I mean, if you look at it from a physiological perspective, it is women who break their bodies and shed their blood for the renewal of life. And that needs to be owned by women and owned by the conversation and what happens in that. So life is more than just, you know, seeding birth. And I talk about the whole, I call it the conception of conception, and how, like in ancient times, you know, they believed women were land. We were owned. And so men were the seed, and men were the seed, and but the seed was all in one, and women were the soil. And so they fertilized women with their seed. Well, that's even ran into the 20th century. So I have a master's in science, and one of the textbook cases of scientific objectivity is the homunculus theory. And so he was a scientist in the early 20th century. And so he was looking at sperm under the microscope. And so, and when he saw this, you know, this new microscope, he saw a full human in that. Well, we all know that that's crazy. You know, the little sperm doesn't encapsulate a whole little baby, but you know, it just kind of, but this made scientific textbooks even as late as the 20th century. And so then by the time I went to college in the late, you know, the mid 90s, you know, this was like a thing of like, okay, look, scientific objectivity, blah, 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 homunculus theory, you know, and we all kind of laughed and made fun of that. But if you look at that from a Christian standpoint, it's like, this is really, you know, pervasive thinking. And so we still, the way we discuss the, you know, creation of new life is we still discuss this in male terms, and we don't give women the power of this. You know, this is our body broken and our blood shed for the renewal of life. And so owning those things and the power. And then also, I think the next place for women on this, if I ever write another book, it will definitely be on the pleasure in that. And so I think we're kind of at a space in feminism of, okay, let's find the power. Let's find, you know, acknowledgement, let's find equality and all of that. That's great. But where is the pleasure in that? Where is the enjoyment in that? Are we finding power? Is it at the expense of our pleasure? And I know for me, I've had to make those decisions. There's not space for me always to find that power and have that pleasure in that, because I'm constantly at battles and arms with the forces that are against me. And so, and this has come to my mind a lot in my clinical work, because I often deal with women have so many issues that are just the physical issues are just so much. I mean, if you look at the drugstore, the shelves of incontinence products, women think that's just a natural part of aging, and it's not. It's a dysfunction. It's a neuromuscular dysfunction of the body that, and even not a lot of medical professionals are aware that, you know, this stuff is rehabilitatable. This is not normal part of aging. And then they come in and I deal with a lot of sexual dysfunction, and I see the whole, like, women aren't allowed to enjoy the experience of their physical flesh, and in rehabilitating that, like, I see even women who function normally aren't always enjoying it. And even if they are enjoying it, then it's so much demonized. Like, it's just like a bad thing. So basically exonerating female pleasure, I think, is kind of the next frontier of this. And that it is.
That's your next book.
That's the next book. Yeah. Yeah. That's the next book for sure. But the body language is termed. So this book was all about the power. This book was about finding power. And so finding power in our flesh. The third section is on, it's called Do the Bright Thing. And it's just
do the bright thing.
Do the bright thing. And so it's about making decisions in our lives that are going to make a step towards our power. So, for example, I use a story. Each reflection starts out with a story. It's a personal story of mine. Perhaps sometimes I share about just different things. But one story I share about, my daughter was 3 years old at the time, and we were having a house church, and we were singing This Little Light of Mine. Well, she decided to use her tallest light to sing This Little Light of Mine. So she's flying a bird for everybody to see, and we're all smiling and singing. And so she was very insistent. Nobody was shining their tallest light for Jesus. That was very confusing. You know, why wouldn't you want to shine your tallest light? And so, you know, nobody's shining their tallest light. She, you know, is hitting it higher and, you know, she's higher in the air and all of that. And so, but, you know, and the whole point is sometimes shining our tallest light as women can be offensive. And so I discuss a story of a foreign woman with Jesus who she was wanting her, I believe her daughter healed. And, you know, Jesus is kind of outside of the beaten path of Jerusalem. He's out in a foreign land and he's on her turf and all of that. And she's like, I want to, and his disciples are like, you know, go away, blah, blah, blah. And she's like, go away. You know, we only give to the dogs, you know, and that's typical of what women, you know, when they want their power, when they're shining their light to get their power associated with dogs. But you look in scripture, this woman did end up getting, she did get the power she wanted. And if you look in scripture too, she is the only person in scripture to win an argument with Jesus. So everybody else was, you know, they all lost. They couldn't get it. But this woman was brazen enough to shine her tallest light. And she is the only person in scripture. She wasn't a Jewish woman. She wasn't, you know, but she shined her tallest light and she's the only one who won an argument with Jesus. She got what she wanted. And so I think, you know, taking those opportunities to shine our brightest light or do the bright thing, I'm sorry, shine your tallest light, but then to do the bright thing. And I give specific examples of how women can do that in church environments, how we can bear witness as women. And I also discuss a little bit too towards the end about empowering little girls. And so I end the book, it actually ends with that. And I mean, with four children, they're our most important thing. They're our greatest asset. They are, I mean, what is the world without children? And I personally believe we as humans have failed in, you know, God gave some specific, I don't discuss this in the book, I do in some blogs, but, you know, we're called to create a life around children, to, you know, teach them as we're walking in the street and teach them, they're supposed to be with us. And what's kind of happened in our world is we don't want to deal with children. And then we say, oh, well, women, you go deal with them. We don't want them in our, you know, we don't want them here. We don't, you know, and how much different would life look if we actually put children at the center of our world? And I'm not saying like, give them everything or spoil them. That's not even what I'm talking about. But, and again, I work in a clinical setting. That's not appropriate for children to be there with me, with my patients, but allowing, you know, through private practice, I'm able to tailor my hours so that I can, you know, be with them and meet their needs. And how much greater would it be if our schools and society would allow the children to have options so that the parents and the children could be together so that we could, you know, do more of that. So anyway, I really, you know, how we empower little girls is important. And in scripture, there's not a lot of highly things said about little girls. We have some things, you know, we got David with the slingshot and all of that. But yeah, I found in scripture and doing this book and being a reader of the Bible is that there's always one story, there's always like the story on the other side that's not getting told. And so little Miriam, you know, she negotiated world peace and she food for her family and the life of her brother. And she did this peacefully with the foreign enemy all in one sentence. And so, you know, you don't have to get the slingshot out and decapitate the enemy and stuff to do the same thing. You know, girls have power in that. And there are girls in scriptures who do that, but we need to elevate these stories. And so
we tend to read right over them.
Right, right. And so that's the whole point of the book, is to, you know, introduce that lens and to do that. And so at the end, my final reflection, which is kind of its own thing, and I talk about, you know, women, we're all about the hair, right? Guys all have the same haircut, most of them. Now there's two. So you got the guy haircut and then you got the like dude bun or whatever, which I think my son is growing something like that. But for the most part, you know, hair in women, there's just a lot of diversity and a lot, we're all about the hair and it's a very defining feature. And so in Christianity, there's discussion about women's hair. In every religion, there's just discussion about women's hair. And so, you know, I'm kind of like, well, why, you know, we focus this much and we groom our hair, but how about we groom ourselves for power? How about we groom ourselves to go and seize these opportunities? And how about we not worry about our, you know, take that chance? And it really became evident to me when my sister had cancer and lost her hair and, you know, dealing with all of that. And now I deal with these women after cancer and the hair, it's just always such a big deal and emotional part of their identity. But I thought, well, what if women thought of their identity like they did their hair, like their power? What if they thought of this? It's like, we would have a different world. It would be a different place. And so I encourage women to groom each other for their power that God gave them. We were created in God's image and we need to own that. And there's female imagery of God in the Bible, all throughout the Bible. And so we need to honor that and publicly recognize that. That's in the book. I created the term guidolatry. And so I talk about all of the images of God that we see in public worship are masculine, while the Bible holds just as many images. I'm talking mode. So if we, like, okay, Lord's throughout the Bible, but if we use Lord once and we use the mode, there's just as many female imageries, but we're unwilling to recognize or embarrassed, or we even, you know, people think it's heretical or all of that, of female images of God in the Bible. And so owning that as women, when we find our power in that, that we are created with the power and the pleasure that, you know, God created us with, and owning that and pushing that into a public space with each other.
Right.
And so that's kind of the final go-to, is go, you know, go find your power.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, awesome. Tara, it is, it's awesome having you here, and I wish you great success with your book. Again, let's read the title again, Pink Sunglasses and Yoga Pants, 31 Reflections on Biblical Feminism.
Correct.
So,
well, thanks for having me on today.
You're welcome. You're welcome. It was great having you here. It's great to see you again.
Yes.
Tara and I have been friends on Facebook for a number of years, over the last several years. We haven't actually seen each other in person in a very long time. So it was very good to see you again.
You too.
Before we close out, I would like to, I've got this little thing I do.
Yes.
It's called the random question box.
Oh,
yeah. And in front of Tara sitting here is a little Tupperware box that's got a handful of questions in it. If you could pull one out, read it, and then we'll just have a little fun with whatever that question is.
Well, this is like my beauty pageant days where you get up on stage and you don't know what they're going to ask you. So you are,
That's the fun. That's the fun of it.
Okay. What is your favorite music genre, artist, and song? Wow. Okay. Well, I like a lot of different kinds of music. You know, Thursday night, I was just at a Madonna concert. I hiked it to Chicago to go see her because she hasn't been in the United States for like ever. And, but she's not, Madonna is a dancer, not a musical artist. So that needs to be very clarified. And mm-hmm. I am very clear on that. Favorite music genre, artist, and song. I teach yoga. And during the yoga music, I use a lot of indie kind of music that I was not religiously spiritual, but is kind of a deeper meaning of life and existence and that sort of thing. And so actually I buy a lot of their music when I find one I like. And when I travel, that's one of the things I'm always looking for is a local musician from that area that I can take home their music with me and potentially use in my yoga classes for them, or reach out. I sometimes have the videos too that I do. And so then that enables me to support them. So yeah, I would say independent music that's more of a beat, but slower, that you can do the yoga to. So yeah, that's probably what I listen to the most and like.
Cool. Well, yep. I think mine is, I was a teenager in the late 70s.
Right.
So, I'm an Eagles fan.
Oh yeah. So, yeah. 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 Uh-huh.
So I really like Hotel California.
Right.
And Take It Easy. And,
sure. Yeah.
It's fun. It's funny. You can get a little bit ironic. Do I take it easy or do I push it to the limit one more time?
Well, there's never the right. Yeah. 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 Right. That's funny.
Lately though, I've been listening on Pandora to, the Jason Mraz.
Oh yeah. Channel. Yeah. So he's great. Uh-huh.
Listening a little bit of him. And the other day there was a Norah Jones, song.
Oh, she's good. Out. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh man. I love Norah Jones.
Yeah. She's good.
Oh, man. So smooth. So smooth.
This question's making me think. I tend to listen to my kids' music because I'm always wanting to know what they're listening to and what they're doing. And I'm realizing that I'm like listening more to my kids' music, so I know what's going on and have a discussion with them. I really like that Taylor Swift song, Calm Down. I really like her song. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, Taylor Swift, yeah. Calm Down's good.
But how often does that actually work? If somebody says, hey, calm down.
Oh, yeah, but her song is funny. Her song's good. You need to calm down. Uh-oh.
Okay, folks, well, we're going to go ahead and wrap it up. And as usual, I usually share a passage of scripture that I think has something to do with creativity. And so today I'm going to read Psalm 108, verses 1 and 2. It's a Psalm of David. I mentioned in my last podcast that David was a poet and he was a musician, and we don't often notice that. So here he writes the psalm. It says, my heart, O God, is steadfast. I will sing and make music with all my soul. Awake harp and lyra. I will awaken the dawn. I messed that up. I'm gonna have to read it again.
Don't abandon the dawn, Mike.
Don't abandon the dawn. We can abandon hope. That's my book, but right. we can't abandon. I see, yeah. I'm gonna reread that. My heart, O God, is steadfast. I will sing and make music with all my soul. Awaken harp and lyra. I will awaken the dawn. So, folks, thank you for joining us on the Cutter's Notch podcast today. You can pick up Tara's book through Amazon. Is
that correct? Mm-hmm.
So just search for Tara J. Hanna, pink sunglasses and yoga pants, and you'll be able to purchase her book, and she'll be very grateful.
That's right.
When that money pops into her account.
That's so right.
Authors do like to be paid. So if you would like to search it out, pick it up. If you like it, that would obviously be helpful to give her a positive review. So thank you very much, Tara.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
The Cutter's Notch podcast can be found through any podcast listing provider. New episodes will drop approximately twice per month. Connect with Michael at the following email address, authormichaeldecamp@gmail.com. Again, that's authormichaeldecamp cuttersnotchpodcast@gmail.com. Abandon Hope. A Cutter's Notch novel can be purchased as an ebook, paperback, or hardcover through any bookstore, both online and local. Get your copy and start your own Cutter's Notch adventure today.